You pass through the waters that will be with you, and through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. In a world of broken promises on this first Sunday after Epiphany, I am thinking about God's promise. The most significant thing to notice about God's promise, my late friend and theologian Robert Jensen says, is that it poses a future in a very particular way. It poses the future as gift. The rest of our communication, Jen says, various as it is, shares one common character. It poses the future not as gift, but as an obligation. We say things like, if you do such and such, then so and so will happen. So it goes in Washington, or not. In this way, we pose a future that is bound to the past. But God alone promises in the opposite way. God says, because I will do such and such, you may await so and so. So whereas other communication makes the future dependent upon the past, God's promise makes the past depend on the future. For it grants a future free from the past. Another word for this sort of promise, it says, is forgiveness. Forgiveness. The church acts out this sort of promise in the sacrament of baptism. Today we have told the story of Jesus' baptism, and we will remember our dying in the waters of baptism to the life we were living without God, our dying to sin, and our being born into a whole new life, into a whole new family, as God's child. Without ties, wake each morning and begin again to live as beings who are destined to become human in God's love. If anyone is in Christ, Brian said to you this morning, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. Imagine that. So far, so good. Except for the fact that the life of the baptized often looks to all the world exactly like the life of the unbaptized. Considering our part of the promise post-baptism, we still live forgetting God. Concerning God's part of the promise post-baptism, God apparently continues to make the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends snow on the righteous and the unrighteous. Surely that is what 2 Isaiah observed as he spoke to the children of God who were living in exile. When you pass through the waters and through the rivers, when you walk through the fire, and flame. Bad things are happening in Babylon to God's good people, and in Philadelphia, and in Bethlehem, and in Damascus. Apparently, the same God who said in the previous chapter, I have taken you by hand and kept you, I have called you by name, you are mine, is the God whose promises in the next chapter have nothing to do with protecting God's people from the death-dealing powers of rising waters, or raging fires, or ruthless pestilence. What, then, is God's promise good for? What exactly is God promising if God is not promising a life set somewhat free from sorrow and pain, from suffering and grief? Listen again to the promise God makes to exiles who are beginning to believe the evidence of God's absence. The promise is not that they will be spared deep waters, nor is God's promise a promise of protection against fire and flame, for that would be a false promise. Because God has given God's people the gift of mortal life and has set them in a world where death-dealing powers presently vie for their allegiance, God's promise is a promise within limits. Therefore, God promises not if, but when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. That is to say, life will continue to throw punches our way post-baptism. So let me rephrase the question. What difference does God's promise make? What difference does it make in the midst of the fray when you are down for the count that God has promised to be with you? Over the last 23 years, you have been telling me that God's promise to be with you has made all the difference in the world. How do people get through this? You ask me in a hospital room, or walking away from an open grave, or in the midst of some great upheaval. How do people get through this without God in their lives and the church by their side? The question makes me think presently of Martin Luther and his struggle with doubt and depression, believing he was literally doing battle with the devil back then. Luther wrote in chalk on his desk each morning, "Baptizatus sum, I am baptized." First person, singular, perfect, passive, indicative. Thank you, Margaret Spencer. Likewise, I know I would forget this because I brought it with me this morning and it's in my purse, but I keep my baptismal certificate from 1956 on my dresser to remind me that no matter how deep the waters, hot the flame, God will not abandon me, because I do not know how I would make it through this mortal life without God's promise to be with me, a promise God keeps without limits in Jesus Christ. But as important as the first person singular perfect passive indicative is, more must be said. And the more has to do with the third person plural present imperative lives we live publicly in response to the epiphany of God's light in darkness, in response to the manifestations of God's tender mercies in this weary world, in response to the revealing of God's reign in almost every reversal of fortune. The difference, another late friend and theologian Paul Lehman insists, is that for believers, the cross is real. In the world that is among unbelievers, it is hidden. The church, he says, lives as the people who know that the victory has been won. Don't you wish you were living today knowing that? Church lives as people who know that the victory has been won. The world lives on as if nothing had happened. The church realizes that the powers which militate against God's promises are ultimately under control. The world lives on as if these powers were still able to shape the ultimate destiny of mortals. The difference, Raymond says, between believers and unbelievers is not defined by church membership or even, in the last analysis, by baptism. Rather, the difference is a matter of behaving with confidence and hope as against anxiety and despair. Of behaving with abandon rather than with calculation. Being all things to all people, he says, rather than pursuing selfish advantage and compiling statistics of evil. Let me therefore rephrase the question a third time. How does it happen that God's promise comes to make that sort of difference in the lives of God's children? In a word, Jesus Christ is how it happens. God sent his Son, his only Son, his beloved, into the waters of baptism and finally onto a cross to keep God's promise to be with us. In him, God accompanies us as we venture into this world of anxiety and despair as a people of confidence and hope. In him, God commands us to behave with love's abandon rather than fearful calculation. In him, God bids us, quit little men pursuing selfish advantage, to follow him whose self-giving love is our destination. And then there are the means of grace he has given to this community. We were baptized into a community that gathers on the first day of the week to ask anew, given the week just passed, what the word of this promising God means and matters. We are included in a community that acts out God's promises at the font and table without condition. How God's promise comes to make a difference in our lives and the life of the world has something to do with how the word spoken and the sacraments celebrated give us eyes to see God made manifest in human history. That's what those stars are about. To repeat what Brian said last week, we therefore begin to look for God with us in places where the world does not look. And we begin to see God with us precisely in the places where the world says God is not, where the waters rise and the fires rage. Now, just in case, after all these words, we're still having trouble imagining the difference God's promises make, consider Hobson United Methodist Church in Nashville, Tennessee. A wildly diverse congregation that includes people with power and PhDs and folks who never made it past the third grade. Folks with two houses and folks living on the streets. And as one person who struggles with mental illness declared, those of us who are crazy and those who think they're not. Years ago, a woman named Fayette found her way conversation about baptism especially grabbed Fayette's imagination. Jen tells us how, during the class, Fayette would ask again and again, "And when I'm baptized, I am..." The class learned to respond, "Beloved, precious child of God, and beautiful to behold." "Oh, yes," she'd say. And then we could go back to our discussion. The day of Fayette's baptism came. She went under, came up spluttering and cried, "And now I am." And the congregation sang, "Beloved, precious child of God, beautiful to behold." "Oh, yes," she shouted as she danced all around the fellowship hall. 2 months later, John had received a phone call. Fayette had been beaten and raped and was in the county hospital. "So I went," Jeff writes. "I could see her from a distance, pacing back and forth. When I got to the door, I heard, 'I am beloved. I am beloved. I am beloved.' She turned and saw me and said, 'I am beloved, precious child of God.' And catching sight of herself in the mirror, hair sticking up, blood and tears streaking down her face, dress torn, dirty, and rebuttoned askew, she started again. 'I am beloved, precious child of God.' And she looked at the mirror again and declared, 'And God is still working on me. If you come back tomorrow, I'll be so beautiful, I'll take your breath away.' When you pass the waters, God will be with you. And through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and flame